University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents a panel discussion on the topic of date rape. Participants in the discussion include Richard Diestbier, professor of psychology at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and a member of 100 Men Against Rape; Leslie Hartford, Lincoln Rape Spouse Abuse Crisis Center; Suzanne Bone, director of mental health, Lincoln Correctional Center; and C. Ebb Munden, pastor, First United Methodist Church in Lincoln. Panel moderator is Elaine Cruz, history professor at Nebraska Wesleyan, and member of the newly formed Campus Committee on Date Rape and Sexual Harassment.
This morning, the forum will be dedicated to the topic of date rape. You have received, as you came in, a letter from 100 Men Against Rape, which is a group dedicated to stopping rape and promoting sexual justice in Lincoln. They're submitting this letter to the editor of the Lincoln Papers and are soliciting signatures to be published around Valentine's Day. Please read the letter, and if you agree and wish to include your name, sign the sheet and include your address and your phone number for verification. The names will be taken to the journal Star and will be in the ad. If you need more information, you can contact John Krejci about that. This morning, our panel will consist of four people. We will begin with Leslie Hartford, who is from the Rape Spouse Abuse Crisis Center as educational coordinator and counselor. Our second speaker will be Suzanne Bond, who is the director of mental health from the Nebraska Department of Corrections. She will be followed by Pastor Ebb Munden from First United Methodist Church. And our final speaker will be Dick Diestbier from UNL, a professor of psychology and a member of 100 Men Against Rape. Well, I might mention that as you leave, there will be a number of materials that have been brought here by Leslie Hartford, a fact sheet called Myths Versus Facts of Violence Against Women, a booklet on sexual assault, and a card from the Rape Spouse Abuse Crisis Center, if you're interested in helping yourselves to those.
Leslie? Thank you. I'd like to welcome everyone here today. What we have for you may not be new information. It may indeed be information that you've received since you were very, very small. Or conversely, it may be information that is brand new. What I would like to do, and what as panel members we would like to do, is to give you this information essentially so that you can do with it what you need to. But also, what we have is the idea that perhaps with this information, what you say and what you do, who you are and how you integrate this information, can really be used to change or modify not only behaviors but attitudes. And we'll talk a lot and in depth about attitudes. As Elaine had mentioned, that the handouts are available. There are also a number of resources available in our community. If by chance, following this forum, you're needing more information, perhaps you're a friend or a family member of a victim, perhaps you're examining your own behaviors, or perhaps you yourself are a victim of a sexual assault, that the Crisis Center is available on a 24-hour basis in Lincoln. There are also a wide array of therapists, private and through agencies, that can address your needs. What we'd like to do, and particularly what I'd like to do, is to challenge you to use your information and to challenge you to examine your attitudes today. Most of us have a certain set of beliefs, a certain set of attitudes, if you will, about sexual assault that lots of times my experience has been in talking to groups very, very similar to this, that we seem to also have misconceptions, that we know what rape is and yet we don't. that we hear about it in our media, and yet we don't. And also, from very, very early beginnings, we seem to believe what we've been told about rape and what it is not. For instance, think back, if you will, to some of your first teachings. What is sexual assault? Well, we all probably knew to be careful of a stranger. But how many of us were able to integrate that information and then expand it to really encompass the realities of sexual assault? Today we'll not only be talking about what sexual assault is, but specifically what date rape is and how it relates not only to the Lincoln community, but to the Wesleyan campus in general. That the information that I bring to you is not only based on theory, but it's also based on discussions in groups like this, in smaller and in larger groups. It's based on victims' perspectives, on families and friends, and it's also based on people who have assaulted and committed assault, and of course Susan will address that. That when I talk about the Wesleyan campus, when I talk about our Lincoln area, it's so easy to somehow say, this happens apart from us. It happens apart from our community. And yet, in working with men and women from Nebraska Wesleyan, from Lincoln, from our smaller towns, what we know is that nationally and locally, our figures correspond. When we talk about the incidence of date rape, if you will, we not only mean someone out on a date, but I'm sure terms that are familiar to you all, such as social rape, acquaintance rape, or rape between people that know each other, all fit the realm of what date rape is. We know that 1 in 3 women in their lifetimes will be or have been victimized by a sexual assault. That of that 1 in 3, or 33%, 75% of those assaults are committed by someone that the victim knows. As I search for statistics and look and constantly am seeking to compare, if you will, what we can find is as low as, if you choose to, 50% of all sexual assaults are committed by people known to the victim, and up to a recent report of 90 to 95%. From our practice and from working with victims, in Lincoln, 75 to 80% seems to be a most accurate figure. What I'm talking about and what we're talking about here today when we talk about sexual assault, you may know by a number of different words. Most frequently, the response that I tend to get is, well, Leslie, you're talking about sexual assault. Tell me about rape. We want to know about rape. And yet, if we look in the Nebraska statutes, what we see is that indeed there are no quote-unquote rape laws, but rather legally what we find are statutes pertaining to sexual assault. However, regardless of the language we use, the effect is the same. Victims process an assault the same way, regardless of whether the assailant is known or unknown. There are some differing factors, but the sense of loss of control, the sense of being overpowered, the sense of vulnerability and issues of trust are foremost for a person victimized. That what we're talking about is not intimacy, it is not passion, and yet date rape or social rape of all forms of sexual assault frequently masquerades itself as seduction or intimacy. We examine coercion. Coercion may be ever so subtle. Emotional or physical coercion may be equally powerful, and coercion is very, very prevalent in a date rape situation. We know that most sexual assaults do not involve the use of a weapon, a gun, a knife, but rather coercion or the threat of force. When we talk about sexual assault or rape or date rape or acquaintance rape, what we see is not only forced intimacy, not only forced sexual intercourse, but, if you will, referring to the statute, that sexual assault, including date rape, is any time there is not only penetration of a victim's body, but intentional touching of a victim's body, where force, the threat of force, deception, coercion, manipulation, or trickery is used, even when that trickery is someone's authority or sense of authority in a relationship, using trust that's already been established. That our attitudes, again, live and breathe and are very much alive on a Wesleyan campus in Lincoln and in Nebraska. Current attitudes that suggest from studies of younger men and women and also college-age men and women that while asked if rape was okay, most people said no. When asked if sexual intimacy, forced sexual intercourse was okay, our figures and our attitudes show a much different perspective. That 36% of college men surveyed said it is okay to force sexual intercourse if you've touched her above the waist. It is okay to force sexual intercourse or sexual intimacy if you're sexually excited. And it is okay to use force if a woman says no after having said yes. In other words, if she simply changes her mind. 61% of college-age men in a survey of 800 in a Midwest campus very similar to ours today admitted to forcing some type of intimacy. What I ask you to do is, are you part that says it's okay? That somehow rape is different? That rape is just sex, and why bother? That attitude lives. Or are you aware of the impact? Are you aware of your attitudes? And exactly what sexual assault is and is not? Turn it over to Suzanne.
What I would like to address is the offender himself. The current theme in mental health these days and in society is that society's attitudes play a big role in relationships between men and women in particular, and relationships between people in general. Excuse me. What I'd like to have us remember is we still have to assume responsibility for our own behavior. And regardless of whatever attitudes we were brought up with, regardless of whatever your friends may have thought, regardless of whatever you saw in your own home, whatever you might have seen your own parents doing, you still are responsible for your own behavior. And we need to focus on that behavior if we're going to be able to change it, in addition to also looking at society's attitudes. We have a lot of stereotypes about what we think an offender is or looks like, and some of those are pretty accurate. The typical rapist, and I include a date raper in the same category as a rapist, is the macho type guy who's into attitudes of power, prowess, control, these kinds of things. This type of individual is not conducive to receiving criticism from other people, especially females. He tends to have an attitude, particular attitudes about women, what their role is, what they should be doing for him. In addition to that, there are a lot of individual differences in the men who rape. They can come from all kinds of different psychological foundations. One of the underlying characteristics of men who rape, however, is that there is a serious psychological difficulty, particularly in their relationships with other people. They tend not to have close, intimate, emotionally close relationships with other people, either with men or with women. They tend to have deficits in warmth, in empathy, in caring about people. This is pretty much typical of any man that I find in the work that I do with men who are incarcerated for these kinds of offenses. Within these parameters, there are a lot of individual differences on why men rape. varying from a person who is grossly mentally ill, psychotic, not in touch with reality, and really not responsible for what he's doing because he doesn't know what he's doing or he doesn't know it's wrong. That is an extreme minority of people that are involved with this type of crime. I'd put it at 5% at most, and maybe not even that high. Some of the other characteristics you might see in typical people is just a proneness for violence in general. These are people who like to get in fights, who, if they're challenged by anybody, male, female, authority, you know, want to get it on right now and get down and fight about it. These are the men also who in marital relationships tend to be wife batterers, and in the context of the marital relationship, which isn't that different from a date relationship, these men tend to be abusive in lots of other ways towards their partners, and often sexual force, intimidation, and violence is just a part of that. We like to think that these men often lack impulse control, or once they are sexually aroused, they can't stop. That is also pretty rare. That very seldom has a major impact in the behavior that they continue with once a woman does say no. More typically, these people truly lack empathic identification. They really have an inability to care about the person that they're with. They're very self-centered. They want to do what they want to do when they want to do it. They don't have any problem in particularly controlling the impulse or knowing that they're having an impact on the victim, but they want to do it anyway. Probably the most dangerous type of individual, and hopefully you haven't run into too many of them, but there's certainly a number out there, are the people who really like to harm other people. And we do see a number of these people where sex, per se, really is not the issue, but they really are intrinsically rewarded by harming other people and by degrading other people. In a particular date situation, typically it is not on a first date that a woman is going to be confronted with this type of situation where it's forced sex or intimidation, or maybe she's had too much to drink and she's not really capable of saying no or yes or anything else at this point. That still is rape, incidentally. Whether the woman is conscious or not, it's still a rape situation. These men have several different motivations behind them, and it's very related to rape in general. Some of the men interpret a no in terms of a sexual relationship as in many different ways, and it's not specifically the no itself that's important, but it's how the individual interprets that no or that refusal to continue or to give sex. Some men have the fantasy that women like to be raped. That's pretty rare that women actually do, but some men do have that fantasy, and they feel that if they can move a woman to that point through force or intimidation, that she's going to like it, and then it's going to cure all the problems. Some men do believe this, and that is a very rare situation where that actually occurs. One of the other things going with our first stereotypes about men with their macho and virility is sexism is equated with virility. And they feel that in order to feel good about themselves, to feel good about themselves as a man, to be able to tell other men that they're a good man, they have to be very virile. And in order to be virile, they have to have a lot of sexual conquest. And they relate sexuality with conquest and with overpowering other women. Very often in a rape situation, rape is equated with power. It's pretty obvious that men generally are much stronger physically than women. Just by their mere presence, they can intimidate women. Very often men will say, well, I didn't do anything to her, but here's a 6'2", 180-pound man with a 5'2", 100-pound woman, and he doesn't really have to do a whole lot in order to intimidate her. And she, if she has sense, isn't going to argue a whole lot with him if she doesn't want to get hurt pretty bad. So in that situation, power is a real issue. And it's not so much the sexuality or the sexual gratification that the man is getting out of this, but it's a sense of power. Oftentimes, sex is equated with love and affection. Some men have never learned to have a true, sharing, giving relationship with another human being, and they have equated sex with love. If she loves me, if she cares about me, she'll have sex with me and she'll like it. we do run into a number of people like that. Relating to the last factor that I mentioned earlier, the people who really like to hurt women, sex for them often can be a symbol of debasement and punishment. If the woman doesn't do what he thinks she should, he took her out to dinner, she owes him something, he takes that as a slap in the face, and he's going to get her. He's going to show her who's boss, and he's going to put her down. You may not feel as though you see a lot of people like this, but you need to really consider, you know, the people that you're with, how caring they seem to be overall, how caring they are with other people, not just with you, but how much regard they give to other people. And those are real important elements of any kind of relationship.
The rise of violence in our society in general and the rise of violence against women and children in particular is, I believe, an expression of an erosion of respect for human life in our culture. The rise of violence against women is an expression of a lack of respect for women by men in our society. I'm pastor of a church, and as pastor of a church, I think I have to acknowledge that the church has contributed to this problem of lack of respect for women in our society. When the church deals with women in its teaching and practices as subservient to males, when the church deals with women as non-persons in the liturgy and language of the church, then I think it's not surprising that boys and men get the message that women and girls can be treated without respect. I think that's something the church needs to take responsibility for, and it may be something which each one of us can do something about in the churches of which we are a part, to see to it that the language in our churches reflect respect for women. But I think that the rise of violence in our society, the rise of violence against women and children, is more than simply an expression of lack of respect by males of women. I think it is also an expression of lack of respect of men for themselves. And it raises the question of where we derive our sense of self-worth in our society. I think we live in a culture where most of us derive our sense of self-worth, our sense of value and respect for ourselves from one of two factors: either success in what we undertake or the approval of others. When other people like us and when we're successful in what we undertake, then we feel good about ourselves and believe that we are persons of worth and value. But when we fail, and all of us do fail sometime, when other people do not approve of us, do not like us, and all of us encounter people who do not like us some of the time, then the bottom falls out of our sense of self-respect. And at the very moment when we need most to believe in ourselves, when we fail and when others disapprove of us, we find ourselves without the ability to deal with ourselves as persons of value. Now, the church and the synagogue teach that our self-worth is derived not from success or other people's approval, but rather from the fact that as human beings we are created in the image of God. And as persons in the image of God, we are each one persons of sacred worth and eternal value and ought to be treated with respect and value, regardless of the circumstances. I think we need to remember that in the scriptures, the purpose of our sexuality as human beings is for intimacy. And intimacy requires affection, tenderness, honesty, and commitment. I think that education can do much to help us rationally be able to deal with those kinds of dimensions of life. But actually, those dimensions of our lives are touch upon an aspect of our being that is irrational. There's a depth to our lives that go beyond just our rational, logical minds. For those dimensions of life, I think ritual is powerful. Ritual touches the depth of our lives where things like faith and hope and love arise. And it is out of the rituals of a faith community that I think we may learn to deal with ourselves with respect and deal with one another with respect. Only out of that kind of mutual respect for ourselves and respect for others can we begin to change the attitudes which influence and determine our behaviors. And I hope you will realize that I'm not talking to you as simply people who have the problem. I share the problem. Every male in this room shares the problem. I think we need to take responsibility for the fact that we have become dangerous to ourselves and dangerous to women by the attitudes that have been cultivated in us by our society. Take responsibility for those and changing them. And I believe that that will take not only education, rationally and logically, but it'll take rituals that form powerful, deep feelings and urges within us.
Well, we've come to see that date rape as an issue, or acquaintance rape, is a very widespread phenomenon. I want to take just a minute to think about where the figures that Leslie was talking about come from, and how it is we reconcile those figures with what we hear so often from law enforcement people and other agencies who compile statistics and figures about rape. We only know about the incidence of rape and molestation as a result of cross-sectional interviews of women in our society. Since it is the case that roughly 1 in 10 rapes gets reported to the police, we have an extraordinarily selective view of what rape is about. To some extent, I want to pick up on the themes that that Leslie developed with respect to this. We think of rape essentially as a stranger rape phenomenon. The rapes that women fear the most are the dark alley rapist with the weapon who comes unexpectedly. And indeed, those are rapes to be feared. Those are the ones that get reported by far the most. Rapes that are reported tend to be those in which a maximum amount of threat and violence and by strangers were undertaken. We don't hear much about the other phenomenon that this topic is actually directed towards, acquaintance rape or date rape. A number of ideas have been developed so far. Suzanne was talking about the lack of empathy and the lack of ability to relate to others that we so often see in the rapist. And Ev has hit upon the problem of one of the institutions of our society, the religious institutions, in making women assume the role of non-persons. There are other elements and agencies within our society that are also problematic, and I want to focus on a few of those. Those that influence not just the attitudes of men, but that influence the attitudes of all of us in our society. Men are the rapists, there's no question, but we must focus upon that as the problem. But men and women both carry attitudes that are conducive to the sort of atmosphere that leads to the high level of rape that Leslie identified for us. We have a society that dangles titillation of various sorts in front of us all the time. We're seeing ads now in the newspapers and on television, in the magazines, that infer a bit of violence in the sexuality that we've gotten used to in the ads. For example, there are ads for some of the jeans now that have men and women dancing together. The woman's clothes have obviously been ripped. This is the sort of thing that not only suggests that some violence has taken place, some aggressive approach to sexuality, which she has come to accept, which she apparently doesn't mind because she's dancing happily with her stud, but also suggests that both people hold the same sorts of attitudes, attitudes that a certain amount of sexual pushing is appropriate. We see these in a lot of the entertainment that we're looking at too, not just the advertisements. A lot of themes that we're concerned with in television and movies and so forth particularly, and those that have been shown to be particularly dangerous with respect to attitudes that seem to foster rape, are the themes that involve woman saying no, man saying, oh yes, we must, man forcing his sexual desire upon the woman, and eventually the woman coming around very much as the ads suggested I described a moment ago, to saying, yeah, that was great. A few orgasms in the context of the rape, and everyone comes out happy. I saw, and I was trying this morning as I was thinking about this talk to remember the name of a movie on television. Don't think it was on one of the pay channels, but rather one of those that we all can get on our cable. A few weeks ago, in which the detective who was the hero of the show encountered a woman in the media. I don't remember, I think she was in television, and they began to have a relationship. But in their first meeting in her apartment, she said, no, get out of here, this is not appropriate. And in the course of what is entertainment that all of us could see, he raped, in a legal sense, and they all lived happily ever after. It was the beginning of a wonderful relationship. Those kinds of themes in our entertainment don't do young men and young women any good when we're concerned about the amount of sexual force and the amount of sexual violence in our society. There isn't too much we can do about that sort of thing except to be conscious of where the real danger lies. We don't tend to see the encouragement of sexual crimes from what people have come now to call eroticism. In other words, pictures of nude people of the opposite sex, the sort of really tasteless X-rated movies that you might see in the local movie house do not tend to be associated with an outcome directly of sexual violence. To be sure, they picture people as objects, particularly women as sex objects. To be sure, they are not very tasteful. They don't seem to be the major problem. Those social scientists who are studying this problem more and more are identifying the typical themes you see in the R-rated movies, the sort of chainsaw, cut off a few legs, and be sure there's a good dose of sex involved in the movie at the same time. Those sorts of things, and again, this picks up on the theme that Eb was developing a moment ago, those themes that focus largely upon violence rather than upon eroticism seem to be more associated with the destructive attitudes and the destructive behaviors that we're seeing too much of in our society. If there is a remedy for this, I believe it lies in the direction of sex education. I don't think it is in the direction of censorship or the loss of our First Amendment rights. Sex education is sadly lacking in our society. Insofar as we have it, it tends to be about reproduction, or what people sometimes facetiously call plumbing. Show me a seventh grade kid, I'll show you a kid who knows about tubes, knows how the egg passes from the ovary down the fallopian tube and where it ends up, where the sperm is developed and where it goes, and so on and so forth. It's this business of sex education, really education about the choices that we make, how we make those choices, that is sadly lacking in our school system, that I wish we had. And just as a final comment, the organization that I was identified with in the introduction, the 100 Men Against Rape, is an organization that's essentially devoted to the idea of education, particularly of young men by more mature men, particularly men, young men, who are the potential dangerous people of our society, receiving education from other men that they can look to with some respect, who essentially say, you can be a man. You can be a man in the full American heroic sense of the word, even, if that's your druthers, without a lot of sexual pushing and force. You don't need to exercise rape on the path to masculinity.
We're going to open up the session now to questions and answers, and we'd like you to address the question to a specific panel member. When you ask your question, I'll repeat it, and then we'll have a specific panel member answer.
Okay, for the second question, you mentioned in the school systems, you said that you thought that education, sex education specifically, is lacking. What about like education in the homes? How do you feel about that? Is that more of a priority than the school systems?
The question is whether sex education should be more of a priority in the homes and how that relates to sex education in the schools.
A couple of things about that. Generally speaking, people who resist education in the schools, and I know that's not the focus of your question, who say that it should be in the homes, do not educate their children in the homes with respect to sexuality. Most of comments that we hear that it ought not to be in a public forum, it ought to be in the home, it ought to be private, are really generated by people who have a resistance to sex education. It is difficult for parents to be good sex educators. Most parents don't know an awful lot about the things that might be most helpful in helping their children to develop the kind of background to have good knowledge about sexuality, and again, I'm not talking about reproduction, or to make wise sexual decisions. In addition to the knowledge problem, there's also the problem that we grow up with our kids in a pact of silence about sexuality. Even parents who say, ask me anything, I'll tell you, generally do not tell their kids when they're going off to bed to make love or doing other things that involve sexuality. I'm not suggesting that they should, but what I am saying is the kids very soon, growing up in any family, even very open families, generally catch on to the fact that there are some subjects that really are taboo between parent and child. You can ask your friends, you can express your attitudes to your friends, but you can't really ask your parents, not safely, lest they give you the sort of lecture that you hope to avoid. And so I think that good sex educators giving good sex education in public settings like churches and schools is a better answer even than in the home.
John?
I have two daughters who will be going to college in a few years. This is for Leslie. What should I tell them? Say they have been sexually assaulted on a date, not raped, sexually assaulted. What should I tell them after the fact? What should they do? What procedure? Where should I go? What should they do?
The question is, what should a young person do after they've been sexually assaulted on a date?
I want to preface that by saying I know your example is with your daughters, with young people, that victims are not simply young women, that there's a misconception that there's only a certain person that is a victim, just like the misconception that there's only a certain person that is a perpetrator. that in Nebraska, what we know is that the youngest victim is 6 months old of rape or sexual assault, that the oldest victim is over 90, that as we talk about what to do and how, essentially, one attitude that prevails is, did I cause or how did I somehow contribute to an assault happening? That question seems to be first and foremost in every single victim's mind, because that's the way we've set it up. For you sociologists or psychologists, a very simple phrase we call blaming the victim. That it's important, if not before an assault, definitely after, to let a person know that they aren't to blame, that they are not at fault any more than the person that is robbed, any more than the person in the new home who has a fire. And that essentially, when people are assaulted, that in addition to not being at fault, no matter what they wore, said, did, or didn't do, and even if they did not say no, number one, that help's available. That feelings of shock, of trauma, of wondering where to go and how to tell are real normal. It's also real normal to deny that an assault happened. So many times, especially in a date rape situation, what's set up is to force the victim to not only believe that she may have somehow contributed to it, but in essence that it wasn't that big of a deal. And so as a society, we tend to minimize, whether it's with college-age men and women, whether it's with professional men and women, unemployed, older adults, or very, very young people. Number one, that help is available. It's not her fault. That in most communities, help is available. Nebraska has 23 crisis centers of some sort. Throughout the nation, there's a nationwide network of sexual assault or rape centers. As you prefaced that also, John, that sexual assault and rape are the same things. One is not worse. One does not mandate penetration or intercourse, while the other is only touching. We can liken it to calling a shirt or a blouse. It is the same garment. It is the same crime. And the effects are the same.
Yes, back there.
Yeah, Dr. Munden was talking of the way we are taught, oh, for instance, in the church, that men are superior to women. And I'm wondering, with the women's movement, if maybe some men feel a little threatened by that and perhaps retaliate to rape in order to achieve that authority.
Are you asking Dr. Munden?
Yes, or anyone else who wishes to.
Okay. The question is whether the women's movement has contributed to a kind of backlash, a reaction against women, and perhaps more violence.
I don't think there's really that much evidence to indicate the fact that men are any more insecure today about their masculinity than they've ever been. I think there is enough evidence to indicate that most of us are pretty insecure about our masculinity, and therefore we do act out a lot of, I think, dangerous behavior by way of trying to reinforce our sense of being macho, the Rambo-type operators. I don't know. I'd have to ask a woman to comment about whether they would feel that the women's movement today may have led to a backlash. It's not my perception that it has. My perception is that there's been a needed correction in the minds of many men about the need to treat women with equal respect. But I think the problem often arises out of a lack of self-respect on the part of the male.
I would like to make a couple of comments about that. I think the women's movement has actually helped in terms of women are overall more assertive than they were years ago. They're more likely to report when they are sexually assaulted. The thing about the perpetrator is, generally speaking, this is a premeditated offense. This isn't something that just happens, or all of a sudden he gets a notion to do it. It's usually pretty well planned out. And the victim tends to be someone who is more vulnerable than a woman who's very assertive, who exudes self-confidence. The perpetrator looks for somebody who is vulnerable and tries to find her vulnerabilities. So I think the women's movement is a very positive impact on society in general.
My experience has also been that if we look historically, even back to Romans referred to the crime of raptus, R-A-P-T-U-S. And raptus was any crime committed against a man's property, including what we would refer to today as sexual assault or rape. Also in cross studies of different women and different ages, women 70, 80, 90 years old will report, when given information, the same percentage of sexual abuse or sexual assault or rape as women who are 20 years old, 30 years old. The difference tends to lie in the reporting and the identification.
Yes, Leon?
I'd like to ask Ed a question. I appreciate, Ed, you're laying some responsibility for the situation on the church. I'm wondering if there isn't a pretty basic problem there in that the creation myth that we operate under is a sexist creation. And how do you deal with that? I mean, God created Adam in his image, and then Eve was a kind of afterthought, made of Adam's rib, a helpmate for us. How do you deal with that?
Well, Leon, it's really not as bad a problem as it is commonly perceived. One of the biggest parts of the problem is that the Bible has been, in the main, translated by men. And men perpetuate this sexist language. Actually, the Hebrew word that we translate as helpmeet, Eve, actually, azer is the Hebrew word, in the Bible does not connote inferiority at all. In fact, it is frequently used in the Hebrew literature as a reference to God. It is a word that does not, in the Hebrew, connote inferiority. It has, by translations into the Greek and then later into the Latin and into the English, come to be understood as a inferior term, particularly in the English, but it is not there in the Hebrew. And I think that the answer for that is largely due to the fact that males have been the translators. The Bible often is sexist. I would acknowledge that there is in the biblical literature much that is sexist. There, it's amazing, though, how much of the Bible transcends that when you recognize the fact that it was written in a patriarchal society and it was primarily translated by males. It's amazing when that fact is considered how much of the Bible does still retain the acknowledgement of the fact that there is in the Hebrew Christian faith a recognition of the fact that both males and females are created in the image of God. They are both alike to be treated with the respect of persons who are God imagers. So, I don't believe the Bible is as sexist as we have often made it. I think the church, because it has largely been dominated by males, has aggravated a problem that's there, but not nearly to the degree that we have made it.
Today, University Forum has presented a panel discussion on the topic of date rape. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.